This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When children's mental health comes to the forefront of public consciousness, it's usually after a tragedy of some kind, either a school shooting that shocks the entire nation or a suicide that devastates an individual school and one community. But many of those who monitor the emotional health of our nation's kids believe that the true toll of untreated mental illness is systematically overlooked. The lack of early diagnosis and help for disturbed kids, they say, can contribute to substance abuse, teen pregnancy, violence, and lead to lifelong problems. The President's new Freedom Commission on Mental Health weighed in on the issue last month in its final report and recommended that schools provide regular mental screening and services to students. The report says school is the best place to catch mental illness early. Critics worry about stigmatizing kids, about interfering with parents, adding another mandate to overburden schools, and about where the money to pay for this would come from. Later this hour, we'll talk about health insurance for college students, but first, the role of schools in the promotion of health care for children health. We want to hear from you, of course. How do you feel about schools screening students for mental illness, and is this something you'd want for your child? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Philip Kultoff. He's the executive director of the Children's Aid Society. And he joins us by phone from his office in Manhattan. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
The report, the White House report that we just mentioned, concludes, or one of its conclusions is, no other illnesses damage so many children so seriously. That suggests that this is a widespread problem.
Yes, it does. I very much agree with much that's in the report. I think that one of the points that the report made quite conclusively was that part of the issue is fragmentation, and the report suggested that there are too many community services throughout our country that aren't tied together. And they suggested, as you did earlier, that the best place to reach the majority of Americans' children, since 90% of our children attend public schools throughout our country, is in the schoolroom. In the school building, where so many children who exhibit so many different issues and problems from both conditional and situational and clinical depression to other severe forms of conduct disorders can be picked up in the school if there's an awareness, if there's an environment to do that, and if, in fact, there's a way to screen and understand and then treat.
Well, having identified the problem, then how do we move towards solutions? And some people would say that, you know, well, let's begin with the fact that, you know, the purpose of public education is to educate students, and they're having a hard enough time doing that. This is yet another burden.
It's true, and that argument and position has been used, understandably, for many years by traditional educators that have felt, again, as you've suggested, that the school is there to teach, and students should be there to learn, and that's it. 15 years ago, some researchers, including graduate students at the Harvard School of Education, did a report which was called Our Two Crises in Public Education. The first was around the internal, you know, curricula, teaching, social promotion, teacher certification, mm-hmm. all understandable. And the second crisis was just what the topic is in our conversation, and that is the needs of today's students, particularly urban students, when they come into the school. And there was a disjunction between the two, they suggested, and we have found that in the schools that we're in New York City and in schools that we've trained social workers, teachers, and health professionals around the country, that you can't expect, and I say this to the, once again, the understandable position of educators, you can't expect students to learn and to be effective learners and to behave themselves in the classroom and to do well on high-stakes testing, which is the norm in America today, if they are depressed, if they've been abused, if they're neglected, if they're suffering from one kind of mental health problem or malady or another. So if you want our education to work, if you want children to stay in school, if you want them to be achievers, and we all do, then you have to address this issue of mental health. And is one very effective way of doing it. Now, the problems with screening are the following, that many parents and civil rights, civil liberties organizations around the country have been very concerned that if screening is done, it won't be done in the context of confidentiality. It might go on a student's record. It might be a stigma that that student carries with them for the student's educational life. And that's real, and that's a problem. And because it has to do with imposing something without there being a context for it, meaning if there isn't a school that has a parent-friendly environment, if there isn't a school that helps to educate a community of what its purposes are in this broader context, then you're going to have parents saying, what are you doing to our children? And you're labeling them. And this has happened in schools in Chicago, in schools in Houston, Texas, and in New York City, where parents have demonstrated when there was a mental health approach being brought in, such as screening, where there was absolutely no previous work being done with community. Got to educate parents. They have to be brought into the school. Community schools are one great vehicle to do this. We have found this in New York, where you build up a sense of trust, where the whole school atmosphere, training of teachers, principals, an extended school day, good, solid recreational and after-school activities are present, where the parents and the children learn to love and trust the school. Then when you introduce screening, as we have in our middle schools in New York, with thousands of students, we have found that 80 to 85% of the parents give consent to do the screenings. And we have found that up to 15% of all the children that we have screened have had substantial depression and mental health problems.
Philip Kultoff, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Philip Kultoff is executive director of the Children's Aid Society. He joined us by phone from his office in New York City. We just spoke about the need for a school-based mental health screening and services for kids. Now we'll talk about how those services might be implemented, what programs might look like. Joining us is Ted Feinberg, the assistant executive director of the National Association of School Psychologists. He joins us by phone from Bethesda, Maryland. Good to have you on the program.
Good afternoon.
And Lori Flynn is also with us. She's director of the Positive Action for Teen Health program at Columbia University's Center for the Early Diagnosis and Treatment of Mental Illness, and she joins us from her office in New York. Good to speak with you as well.
Thank you very much.
Ted, what kind of mental health services are already available?
Well, in many schools throughout the country, there are school psychologists, school counselors, school social workers who are part of the school system, and I couldn't agree with Mr. Kultoff more in the statements he made, that part of what we want to do is make sure that mental health is on a has parity with physical health. We have a well-established physical immunization and requirements for youngsters in every school, and we want to make sure that we add mental health to that component, because we know that mental health should be a part of a child's general health care and concerns. And so we have mental health professionals who are in the schools. We have good relationships in many communities with community resources who can also help in that. So there are resources available, and obviously we believe that there needs to be more resources set up for this purpose, but clearly there are resources that are available that can be used by schools and by the communities they reside in.
Okay, we'll talk more about resources later. But, Lori, your center supervises a program called Teen Screen. It was held up as a model in the New Freedom Commission's report. How does that work?
We're delighted to report that there are communities around the country that have become aware of the need for early detection of child and adolescent mental disorders. We are active in 74 communities in 27 states, and what we do is take a scientifically validated screening instrument. It's loaded in a laptop computer. The youngster puts on headphones, and of course this is only done after parental consent is given. A lot of times done in a health class. That's a great setting to do this kind of screening, because you can combine it with some education, which, as Dr. Feinberg said, is so important. But we do screen the youngsters. It takes less than a full class period to screen, and you get an immediate printout that indicates whether or not the youngster is showing some signs or symptoms, is affirming to some questions that may get at their risk for suicide, and they are then seen by a clinician on site who can contact the parents, have a little conversation, and make the initial decision about whether to refer the youngster on for a full clinical evaluation and potential treatment. So it's done right in school. It's done with parental consent. It takes less than a class period, and it's highly reliable as a way to find out early those kids who may be at great risk, not only for suicide, but for the kinds of problems that often lead kids into substance abuse, alcohol problems, other risky behaviors, or just school failure and the lack of ability to achieve their potential.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's go to Phil, who's on the line with us from Sacramento in California.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call. I'd just like to comment that, you know, as we do have 90% of America's youth in schools, I think it's a very good idea to screen for mental health and work on treating it as well. We don't have I teach in an inner city school here in Sacramento, and we get very little support from our parents. So we don't even have, you know, we don't have to worry about parents, but on the other hand, they don't get anything at home.
And do you think screening is a good idea?
Yes, we do. We just need the money and to expand the school day. We should have the kids till 8 o'clock at night.
You know, one of the things I would mention is that we are fortunate at Columbia that our we have a benefactor who's enabling us to give away our tools and training literally at no cost. We go to local communities, we train folks in how to use our screener, and we assist them with a lot of the materials that can be so helpful in reaching parents and getting community support, because it is a community issue at the end of the day.
And one of the things that's, I think, particularly important to note is that many communities do not have clinics, they do not have hospitals, they do not have mental health centers, or even private service delivery professionals, but all communities have schools. And so access to children in schools and the parents as well is a natural connection for many communities.
Phil, California, as we all know, has some serious budget problems. This teen screen program may not might be provided for free, as Lori Flynn suggests, but there are going to be resources that would have to come out of somewhere else. Is this something you see as a priority?
Absolutely. You know, if we could just, like, think more than 6 months down the road, if we can get these kids not only, you know, with some health, but also just training for regular, normal, everyday life, you know, we will save tons of money in things like, prisons. We won't have to house them in prison anymore. And I just see it as a benefit for everyone.
And there is a cost for doing nothing. The notion that somehow spending money in this way is not sensible. There is a cost for not doing anything, in the sense that it dramatically lowers graduation rates. There are expensive deep-end mental health services that have to be implemented later on. There are increased health costs, and we've already identified the fact that for many youngsters, the juvenile justice system is the mental health support service for them. But clearly, I think we would all agree that that's not the way to do business.
Phil, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
More after a break. We're talking about mental health screening in schools. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing what role schools should play in the detection and treatment of mental illness in children. Our guests are Ted Feinberg, the Assistant Executive Director of the National Association of School Psychologists. Also with us is Lori Flynn, Director of the Positive Action for Teen Health Program at Columbia University's Center for the Early Diagnosis and Treatment of Mental Illness. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255 and the email address TOTN@npr.org. And let's go to Shirley, who joins us from Rochester, New York.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like to say that I don't disagree with any of the speakers' statements about the problem. Mental illness has affected my family in a lot of different ways. But I would happen to feel that schools can be part of the problem. Children have many stresses in schools with high-stakes testing, trying to fit in. And so I think having schools doing the screening avoids having the healthcare professionals and insurance cover these costs, which they won't address for children and adults. And so the whole system is broken, and so this sort of avoids addressing the whole mental health profession and care in our country. And not that schools are doing a bad job, but they can be part of the stress of a child. And I think when you want to solve something like this, you need somebody on the outside who's not part of the problem. Children tend to open up better in a different environment, away from school, maybe away from the social pressures, just all those issues. And so to bring those kinds of mental issues into the school just add to all the other problems that they're having. And, you know, the bottom line is what we're saying is these kids aren't getting the care that they need. And I understand that we don't have the infrastructure, but this avoids having to address mental health in this country.
Yeah.
That's my opinion, and I'll take your response off the air.
Okay, Shirley, thanks very much. Appreciate the phone call. Ted Feinberg, this seems to be up your alley.
Well, it's certainly a concern that mental health services in the schools would not deal with the pressures and the problems that are embedded in schools, and I don't think that's the case. I think when we look at problems that children have, we look at the problems that are coming from within the school and from within the family, within the community, and we try to help that child and the family and the staff deal with those problems in the most effective way. I think I would differ with the caller in this regard. One of the big problems in terms of mental health services for children is access. In many communities, particularly rural communities, the availability of those services does not exist. And so schools, if they have established a good relationship with the families, with the community at large, can be viewed as a trusted resource and can be seen as a place where both children and their families can get some help. And if the help within the schools is not sufficient, then there are opportunities for the school to refer that child, that family, to other resources should they be available.
One of the conclusions of the White House Commission's report, it notes that no agency or system is clearly responsible or accountable for young people with serious emotional disturbances. And as we've commented earlier, it's frequently the criminal justice system that ends up with the problem.
Clearly. Well, that's one of the reasons why screening and sort of raising the visibility of both the issue and the numbers of youngsters that we could do something for, it becomes important. One of the things we found is that when this becomes something that people are aware of, political figures, public leaders begin to respond to the concerns that, you know, we're identifying kids who really have a medical illness, have a significant problem, need help, and we're having trouble providing that help. So it raises the issue and it pushes public officials to respond with the right priorities.
And we're also trying very hard to demystify the process so that, you know, one of the examples I would give to naysayers is that if you got up in the morning and had a pain in your tooth, you'd have no hesitation, for the most part, to call your dentist and get some help. What we try to do within the context of the educational world is to help people understand that mental health issues are should be accepted at the on the same level that we accept physical problems, and try to reduce that stigma to the extent that we can.
Well, part of the problem with that is that people don't necessarily see the same kind of immediate results they do from a trip to the dentist.
Well, that's true, but that places an important responsibility on the mental health field and the mental health practitioners to help convince the people who they work with that the services that are being rendered are helpful, are supportive, and with their participation can oftentimes change the complexion of the situations that they're involved with.
Let's get another caller. Deborah joins us from Phoenix, New York.
Yes, hello. I just would like to comment on the schools. My personal experience, I recently lost my 17-year-old son in April. He would have graduated this year.
I'm sorry.
And thank you. What I feel is the stigma that is attached to mental illness, I have seen it with the teachers and with the administration faculties within my son's school, and that sets an example to the students. And if we can't eliminate this stigma, these students are going to go on carrying that same stigma, and it's just going to be handed down from generation to generation. So I feel it is very important. The screening would get the school more involved, more educated, and I think it's a great thing.
Again, our condolences on your loss, Deborah, and thanks very much for the call. We know that's not easy to talk about.
Thank you.
Lori, let me ask you, how many, you know, obviously no screening system is going to be perfect. The system that you operate, what percentage of students with emotional disturbances do you think it catches?
Well, we think, based on the research that's been done here at Columbia for over a decade, that it's highly specific, catches youngsters nearly all the time. Very, very infrequently would it miss a youngster. Most of these screens are set up to, you know, find kids, and then a further assessment determines whether they need treatment or are just having a shorter-term problem. But it's really, really important to especially look for those kids who have great risk for suicide. We know that that's not a small problem, that we have about 1 million adolescents at any given time who are suffering from depression. And we know that we got information just this year from the federal government that 19% of American high schoolers report that they've thought about killing themselves. 9% of American high schoolers have made a suicide attempt serious enough to require medical attention. So we think it's very important to find these kids, to bring this to the attention of their parents, and to get them connected to care.
Let me ask a question we got from an emailer, Brian Donahue, who's writing from Gonzaga University. Gonzaga, actually, we learned how to pronounce that in the NCAA finals
yes.
A while ago. He writes, I would not deny or diminish the severity of mental health problems for individual teens, but to turn schools, which many students already perceive correctly as disciplinary institutions, into dispensaries of prescription mood-altering drugs suggests an Orwellian nightmare of chemical-induced conformity. Ted Feinberg?
This is an issue that has been raised periodically, and clearly schools are not seeking to drug all of their children or all of their problem children. The mental health professionals, along with the educators who work in schools, try to look at a variety of alternatives to help children deal with the issues that are confronting their lives. The fact of the matter is between 2.5 and 5 million children are not learning or achieving in school because of social, emotional, or behavioral barriers. We know that if those problems exist in childhood, 74% of 21-year-olds with mental health disorders had been diagnosed with problems in their childhood. And so the intent is certainly not to use one prescriptive approach to solve all problems. That never works, and it never makes sense. But using a variety of interventions from both within the school and outside of the school in concert with collaboration with parents and community resources, that seems to make great sense, not only for the children, but for the families and for the school as well.
Let me try to put it another way, because I think it's an important point. We have become comfortable and expect our schools to give our youngsters a vision screening, a hearing test, mm-hmm. because we know that if those problems, which are not necessarily immediately visible, are there, that the youngster's ability to learn and to grow is going to be affected. It's exactly the same with the idea of a mental health checkup. Screening kids for these disorders so that if we find there is a need for help, we can get it to the youngster. The schools aren't necessarily going to be delivering all of those services, but they can be a very important place where the early warning signs are caught, where the screening is done, and where a referral can be made if it's necessary.
Another email question, this one from Bernadette. How many schools have done away with recess and physical activity periods for children? Exercise is a proven treatment for at least some forms of depression. I'd like to see schools try this approach before screening, quote-unquote, my child for depression. Ted?
It's interesting how that question comes up with more frequency than you might imagine. Certainly, letting kids out on the playground is a time-tested good approach for helping kids get rid of some of the excess energy that they have. But to think that would be the strategy to help children who have some moderate or serious emotional problems, I think is somewhat short-sighted. Clearly, we again think that physical health and mental health go hand in hand. But the tailored approach to a particular child's problem really is the way in which we think kids' needs are best dealt with.
Let's get a question from Jean, who's with us from Syracuse, New York.
Hi. Yes, I'm a psychiatrist, and one of the things I'm concerned about is a lot of the kids that will be picked up as having mental health diagnosis or disorders are actually kids that come from dysfunctional families and are the victims of abuse. And what we're seeing is early trauma disorders. I think the knee-jerk response will be, oh, go get the parents since we're mandated to report abuse. But the long-term solution for society should be that we have programs in place to help train parents to be better parents. We don't have that. We don't recognize child abuse that well anyway. And we don't do much about helping parents, who are often abusing parents, also the victims of abuse when they were kids, of helping reverse this cycle, which goes on generation after generation after generation.
Lori Flynn, get a quick response to that.
Well, he certainly points out a very significant problem. We know that there are families that have generations of these kinds of problems, just as the genetics of depression and other mental disorders are also well established. So it is important for our society to look not only to identifying kids who need mental health treatment, but also to recognize that in many cases, their wellness will depend on having parents involved, engaged, and sometimes treated themselves.
Gene, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you for the response. Have a good day.
Okay. And thanks to both of our guests. Lori Flynn, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. I hope people will go to our website if they're interested, teenscreen.org.
Lori Flynn, director of the Positive Action for Teen Health Program at Columbia University's Center for the Early Diagnosis and Treatment of Mental Illness. She was on the line with us from New York. Ted Feinberg, thanks very much to you, too.
My pleasure.
Ted Feinberg, assistant executive director of the National Association of School Psychologists. He was with us by phone from Bethesda, Maryland. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're going to step back now to get a public policy perspective on the issue of school-based mental health services. Joining us is Krista Kafer, a senior education policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation, and she's with us by phone from her office here in Washington, and good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Briefly, can you give us your thoughts about this proposed expansion of mental health services in schools?
Well, I think in some ways it could have merit. There are instances where kids could be screened, and you could find, particularly in high school, teens that are at risk for suicide or depression, and be able to get those kids help. I think if there are constraints put in place for privacy and ensuring that parents have access to surveys and information, that this could be a good idea. There's a question that always is not, how something looks on paper and how something looks in reality. I think it would be important to definitely before funding any large-scale program to do a pilot to see how that works out, to make sure that it doesn't you know, cause any kind of, I guess, an erosion of a parental responsibility or a significant cost, or if it adds yet one more thing to schools. It can be argued that schools already have many things to do, perhaps too much to do, and can't focus on their core mission.
Are there potential pitfalls to the establishment if federal funding and standards for school-based mental health screening programs were set up?
Well, I'm not sure that it necessarily needs to be federal. It certainly could be state-run. It could be done at the community level. It could be done at the school district level. It could be done through private funds. That's, as I read through the commission's report, I think that's the only thing that sort of sent up a red flag with me, is that I don't know that it necessarily has to be federally funded and be a federal program. And I think it's also important to look at existing federal programs and see that, you know, they don't help everybody. There are kids, in this case, kids that would continue to fall through the cracks. I can think of numerous instances where school officials were aware of kids that had problems, mental health problems, or kids that were abused, and everyone knew it, and yet nothing was done.
Because it wasn't necessarily their responsibility. Do you think, you know, some effort on that regard to bring school administrators more aware of the problem, and that to some degree they do have responsibility? As you say, they're focused on their educational problems.
Well, I think there have been some more protocols put into place in schools all around the country on their own free will after the tragic year we had a couple years ago with school violence and a number of shootings. I know that many schools have put into place procedures to deal with kids that have threatened violence or turned in disturbing homework, have assaulted or threatened a student or teacher, that a number of schools have put in standards of their own.
Is, you know, again, everybody wants to do something, particularly after, as you mentioned, the school shootings. Yet, is there a danger that if you do install programs like this, you might be over-optimistic about what they can actually accomplish?
That's what I'm thinking. If we have a screening and we're actually able to, you know, it seems like in many cases we already know who these students are and they're just not getting the help for one reason or another, and that screening would maybe help a few more kids you know, get help. That's why I think it's important that it be piloted first, and that we actually take a look at, you know, comparing a school that doesn't have a program with comparing a school that does have a program, and look at some of those outcomes.
Krista Kafer, if you'll stay with us, we'll continue our conversation after the break and take more of your calls, 800-989-8255. We're also going to be discussing the problems and the issues surrounding health insurance for college kids. You may be surprised at how many students are not covered. If you'd like to join that conversation, give us a call, too. Again, the number is 800-989-8255, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Back in a couple of minutes. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow on the program, the ultimate not in my backyard issue. Nobody wants a released sexual offender in their neighborhood, even one who's served his time and had treatment. The complexity of finding a new home for released sexual offenders tomorrow on this time on Talk of the Nation. Right now, we're talking about screening for mental health and emotional problems for children in schools. Our guest is Krista Kafer, a senior education policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. She's with us by phone from her office in Washington, D.C. And let's get another caller on the line. Kate joins us from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in my mid-40s, and I have bipolar disorder. And I grew up basically undiagnosed and untreated. And I also went through undergrad undiagnosed and untreated. And it was, you know, I can't, for the people who are so concerned that the stigma might attach to their child, or that, you know, it really isn't appropriate to screen children for this, I still carry the burden of what my life was like when I didn't know what was wrong with me. And you can look at my transcripts from college and see my mood cycles by my grades. I mean, I'm very fortunate I graduated with honors still from engineering school, but it was so hard and the scars are so deep. And now we know even that your brain is affected, you know, structurally and functionally with with repeated untreated episodes of depression or manic depression or the onset of schizophrenia. So it's so important that early diagnosis is made, and we know more and more now that young children have these illnesses. We didn't used to think that. But the stigma thing I'm also very concerned about, because I have had people, you know, we have legislators in Michigan trying to pass laws that basically say certain mental illnesses in children don't even exist, instead of focusing on how can we reach these kids and how can we get past the stigma and how can we find the funding either through the public sector or through parity and private insurance to treat them. Instead, we're worrying about whether or not somebody might be diagnosed when it's really a matter of, you know, pulling themselves up by their bootstraps.
Yeah.
It's not that.
Kate, obviously, you know, you certainly would have been better off if you'd been diagnosed earlier and gotten treatment. But this obviously wasn't in place then, and the issue of confidentiality has been raised. Would you have been able to get into engineering school, do you think, if there'd been a big red flag on your application from your school?
Well, you know, when you get into your next segment about, you know, coverage in college, you know, more and more children, because of medications that work, who have serious mental illnesses, are going to college. And you're right. I would have had trouble. I don't think I'd have gotten the scholarship offers that I received. And it would make it more difficult in employment. And even though the ADA exists, you know, confidentiality doesn't work as well as it should. And I still, to this day, as a self-employed freelancing person, I cannot get health insurance that covers mental health. And I can't get short-term disability insurance that covers it, or long-term disability, or life insurance.
Hmm.
And so, yes, I mean, there's a big gap between diagnosis, finding treatment, and overcoming stigma, and I really believe it's stigma that's at the root of all of it.
That
we really just have such an attitude, it's still appropriate to discriminate. You know, we would never think of treating an ethnic minority that way or a racial group that way, but this is one thing that it's still perfectly legitimate in most people's minds to be discriminatory about.
Well, Kate, again, I know these things are not easy to talk about. Thanks very much for the call.
Well, thank you so much for the topic, and I hope you come back to Grand Rapids sometime and maybe talk about baseball instead of Iraq.
Baseball's a much funner topic.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And Krista Kafer, I know Kate's story is obviously necessarily anecdotal, but in terms of a programmatic approach to this, where do you think this subject goes from this commission's report, which has landed on the president's desk?
Well, it's hard to say. What starts off in the administration ends up getting usually radically changed once it goes to Congress. I do want to comment on something with the caller, is that I think one thing I like about this commission's report is that it is raising the subject in a very public way. And I wonder if just talking about it on radio, on TV, in the newspapers, hearing stories like hers will start to erode some of that stigma, because the stigma, it is tragic, and it prevents a lot of people from getting help. It silences a lot of people. I don't know that there's necessarily a government solution to that. It certainly is a societal obligation to begin to erode some of those barriers in society that prevent people from talking about it or prevent people from reaching out to other people who suffer from some sort of mental illness.
Well, Krista Kafer, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Krista Kafer, a senior education policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. She joined us by phone from her office in Washington.